Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUSCast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. Today, we have a moderated discussion on Relentless Incorporated versus Department of Commerce and Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, in which the Supreme Court issued a 6-3 and 6-2 decision, respectively, on June 28, 2024. It is my honor to introduce our moderator and our guests today. Our moderator is Professor Kristen Hickman. Kristen is a distinguished McKnight University professor and Harlan Albert Rogers Professor in Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. Our first guest is Professor Ronald M. Levin. Ronald is the William R. Orthwine Distinguished Professor of Law at the Washington University in St. Louis School of Law. Our second guest is John J. Vecchione. John is Senior Litigation Counsel at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, and he is the counsel of record for Relentless. And with that, I would like to turn things over to Kristen to give us the background of the case.
The Loper Bright and Relentless cases, which we're here to talk about today, involved a challenge to a National Marine Fisheries Service interpretation of the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act. That statute establishes a system for developing fishery management plans that includes requiring government observers to be carried on board domestic fishing vessels to ensure compliance with the plans. The agency adopted a rule requiring the fishermen themselves to pay for the observers if federal funding was not available to cover that cost. Unsurprisingly, fishing boat owners were not happy with that rule, and they challenged it in court. Both the D.C. Circuit in Loper Bright and the First Circuit in Relentless upheld the agency's rule as a reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous statute under Chevron Step 2. The Supreme Court took the case expressly for the purpose of considering whether to overturn or clarify the deferential Chevron standard of review. I think probably everyone is familiar with the Chevron standard, which called on courts first to determine whether the meaning of the statute at issue was clear. But if that statute wasn't clear, if it was ambiguous, then the Chevron Step 2 called on courts to defer to reasonable or permissible interpretations by the agency of the statute. Justice Jackson was recused from Loper Bright, but not from Relentless. And in his 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court did, in fact, overrule Chevron by name, holding that the deference that Chevron requires cannot be squared with the Administrative Procedure Act because Chevron defies the APA's command that the court is to decide all relevant questions of law and interpret statutory provisions. The court did not resolve the challenge to the Fisheries Service regulation in question. Instead, the court remanded the cases back to the circuits for reconsideration. Justice Thomas wrote a separate concurring opinion in which he reiterated his view that Chevron also violates separation of powers principles. Justice Gorsuch wrote a concurring opinion to discuss his views regarding stare decisis and common law understanding of the judicial role. Justice Kagan wrote the dissenting opinion, joined by Justice Sotomayor, and with respect to the Relentless case, Justice Jackson. So there's a lot to talk about in these opinions. I have my own thoughts that I can and will share as we go along, but first I want to turn the microphone over to Ron and then to John to share their perspectives regarding these decisions. So Ron, why don't you start us off, please?
All right. Thank you, Kristen. I'm grateful to the Federalist Society for inviting me to be part of this. Well, the advent of Chevron in 1984 was the culmination of a long line of precedents in which the court articulated a strong expectation that courts should give great weight to administrative interpretations or language similar to that. And that expectation was just one factor in the interpretive equation, but it was an important element of the administrative common law. In the modern era, courts are more formalist. They don't like overt administrative common law. So in Chevron, that principle was reformulated as a presumption about what Congress would probably intend for courts to do when they encounter an ambiguous statute. I don't think that was a drastic departure from prior law, but just a reformulation. So what is this longstanding law? Well, it's always been agreed that if a court finds a clear message in a statute, it should follow it. Chevron reaffirmed that point. But the important question has always been, if Congress has not taken a clear stand itself, who should fill in the gap? Should it be the administrating agency or should it be the reviewing court? The dissent in Loeber-Bright argued there were several good reasons to assume that in this situation, Congress would generally want the agency to make that call. For one thing, an agency tends to be experienced with the subject matter of the appeal, which can be quite specialized or complex. And generalist judges usually don't have the same level of familiarity with the agency's challenges. And for another thing, an agency has a congressionally assigned responsibility to implement the program to achieve its goals. It needs flexibility to deal with emerging challenges that Congress may not have anticipated. And it's fair to assume that Congress would want it to have that flexibility. And furthermore, as Chevron brought into the debate, agencies are politically accountable for their interpretations of ambiguous statutory interpretation. They answer to the president, they answer to the legislative branch through oversight, hearings, and budget process, and so forth. So indirectly, they answer to the people. But unelected judges have no such accountability. They can be entirely out of touch with public sentiment. Now, I would argue that's exactly what's happening these days, and that may not be the kind of language that wins hearts and minds in a Federalist Society event. But even if you don't agree with me about current events, the structural difference is clear. Now, at the same time, Chevron was always a presumption which could be rebutted. So that doctrine was refined over time to allow for significant judicial controls over agency action. Now, Loeber-Bright does not try to exclude those practical considerations from judicial review entirely, but it suggests that reviewing courts can display so-called respect to administrative interpretations under the so-called Skidmore test. Well, as our moderator's excellent scholarship has demonstrated, Skidmore has been applied in very different ways at different times by different judges. And Roberts seems to envision a very weak version of Skidmore in which a court has the option of showing respect to the agency's views, but there's no strong expectation that he should, as Chevron would have suggested. As I read the Loeber-Bright opinion, if a judge says in a given case, I don't respect the agency at all, and I never have, and so I won't give any weight to its views, that would not be reversible error. I think that's the gist of the change that Loeber-Bright has wrought. Now, given that Chevron provided a stable framework on which countless decisions have been predicated for four decades or so, what reasons does the court give for abandoning it? The court relies on the language of the Administrative Procedure Act. And I've done a fair amount of scholarship on that exact issue, and I consider the court's rationale, if I can use a technical term, specious if not preposterous. Since this is a case about fishing, it's kind of a red herring. The Act provides that a viewing court shall decide relevant questions of law, but it doesn't say how to decide them. The court reads into those words a prohibition on deference, but that reading was not supported by the congressional sponsors of the Act, nor by the courts in the immediate wake of its enactment. They knew very well that the Act was not intended to change the law of judicial deference, so they went on applying deference principles just as they had been doing before the Act passed. And nor was the Loeber-Bright view shared by three generations of judges in the intervening years, including leading judges who lean a bit to the right, like Henry Friendly and William Rehnquist and Antonin Scalia and Ray Randolph and countless others. So the de novo interpretation that the court now endorses never got traction until the rise of the anti-government movement of about a dozen years ago. And so I view the APA argument the court makes as more of an excuse than a serious justification. Another argument in the Loeber-Bright opinion is that the Chevron doctrine became too complicated and loaded down with refinements. But I think Roberts has the argument backwards. Those distinctions were part of a very commendable continuing effort to refine the doctrine. and strike a balance between the judicial and administrative spheres. But now Loper Bright has thrown out that body of precedent, which administrative lawyers understood fairly well, and everything will be up for grabs in the coming years. We're going to see endless arguments about whether to apply strong Skidmore, weak Skidmore, or something in between. It'll be very disruptive, I think. I think the real explanation for what's going on here is that it's part of a campaign by the Supreme Court to challenge the administrative state on a number of fronts. If you put it together with the past term's decisions in Jarczy and Ohio against EPA, and the recent creation of the major questions doctrine, Loper-Bright also bespeaks reluctance and maybe refusal to share interpretive power with another branch of government. It's no wonder that some people are calling this decision a power grab. I might not choose that language myself, but I agree that it bespeaks the majority's overconfidence in its own judgment. I'm pretty sure John's going to tell us in a few minutes that the decision restores the separation of powers. But to my mind, Loper-Bright will tend to undermine checks and balances and subvert the separation of powers. And these are radical moves that I would not call conservative. So I'll leave it at that.
John, go ahead, please.
So I'll add to the professor's list as to Judge Silberman, who, as far as I know, unlike Scalia, showed no sign of changing his views on Chevron before he passed away last year. So there was a lot of that. And right. Now I have to change my Federalist Society bio, because I'm also counsel of record in Relentless and counsel of record for most of the individual plaintiffs in Murthy. So it's been a big term. And I happened to guess right, and I was in the courthouse on Friday morning to watch it come down. And I did not get the impression either there or upon reading the case that Skidmore respect is as perilous condition as the professor has remarked. I'm going to have to read it again because that's interesting to me. But here's my views. I'll just say, when I was at Cause of Action, we started the Loper-Bright case, and Cause of Action decided not to do third-party cases anymore. So when I went to NCLA, I did Relentless. So I was involved in both of these from pretty much the inception. And we filed up in Rhode Island with Relentless. They were in D.C. For Loper-Bright. One of the things that's interesting about this, and I think shows the weakness of Chevron, is if you want to talk about how different courts looked at it, the district court in Loper-Bright found the statute was clear, and the government won because this was perfectly allowed under the statute without reference to Chevron. The First Circuit, in what I think is a classic Chevron, the D.C. Circuit, I think, wrote a very strong opinion on how you're supposed to do Chevron and found only with Chevron deference. It's not clear. There's ambiguity. So the government wins. Of course, there was a strong dissent, which probably got this taken by the Supreme Court. Then in the First Circuit, Judge Smith, Chief Judge from Rhode Island, he did almost the exact same thing as the D.C. Circuit did. But then it went up to the First Circuit, and the First Circuit wrote what I call a mushy opinion. They didn't say whether it was because it's clear or because of ambiguity, but they invoked Chevron and they invoked the steps. So I think they invoked Chevron. And I obviously am thrilled with the result, and I am thrilled with the reasoning as well, because what this does is there is no expertise in the agency. You talk about a power grab. Congress refused in 1990, in this case, the Magnuson-Stevenson Act was amended by Congress to make clear that observers could come on fishing boats to make sure you're catching the right amount of fish and the right kinds and the size, all the various laws that the Magnuson-Stevenson Act gives to the Secretary of Commerce. And it is a very powerful law. It says the secretary may or the secretary must, like scores of times. So he has lots of power, but what the agencies didn't like is Congress did not use its funding power and the power of the purse in the way the agency wanted. They wanted more money for observers. Congress would not give them more money for observers. So what you had was an agency at odds with the chief funding organization of the United States, without which you should not be able to spend a penny getting in a fight with Congress and saying, you know what we're going to do? We're going to charge the regulated for these observers. My clients and the Loper Bright, the clients of Cause of Action, had no chance to oppose this in before Congress, before their elected representatives, because when that amendment went in the 1990s that the observers had to go on the boat, all the fishermen shrugged and said, yeah, I guess they have to. There was no opposition to it, none, not from any of the fishing organizations, not from any of the congressmen who are very sensitive to these fishing issues, because no one thought it would cause this funding problem because it's not in the statute. So then what happened? You come forward 20 years, the agency decides, you know what? We have Chevron. We're going to say that we need more observers. So we're going to create these observers. We're going to make the industry contract with these observers and pay them. And pay them more. There are sections of the Magnuson-Stevenson Act that allow observers to be paid by industry in various means. One is up in the Northern Pacific, which if you watch The Most Dangerous Catch, that's where they are. It's highly capitalized, the most profitable fishery in the world. And they allowed this something like this to happen, but they said, but it's capped. You can't, no more than 3%. And the same with another section, which are laps where the fishermen split all the fish in an area. That too was capped by the Congress, 3%. And then the foreign fisheries, because they don't pay any taxes and they're using our resources, they also have a place where they have to pay. But each of these, and I think that's capped too. So when Congress was looking at it, they capped it. They said what a reasonable rate was where they allowed it. And they didn't allow it here. But because of Chevron, the agencies thought, well, we'll slip it in. And there's nothing the fishermen can do because they're then going to have to be moving through Congress because we will give them a fait accompli. So I think the power grab was on the administrative side. And I think it's easily demonstrated because who pays is not something that Congress can't figure out. Who pays is a congressional question that the administrative agencies in this case had seized. That was our argument, and I think it prevailed. The other thing that's going on here that I don't think Loper Bright gets rid of, which is interesting from a textualist and an originalist position, is they want to give, the court seems to be very upset, both at oral argument in here, of if the agency has a reasonable construction of a statute and what regulation can do. They, as long as it's reasonable, they can change the law 180 degrees every administration. The court seems to be very upset about this. I mean, Brand X isn't explicitly overruled, but Brand X is getting to them, I'm pretty sure. So what I think that the opinion does is when we're looking for the meaning of the statute and what regulations allows, if you're the administration that got that law passed and you start implementing regulations at that time, though the interpretations at that time, I think, are going to be given some kind of weight, if not deference. They're going to look at it and say, well, they got it passed. They kind of knew what it means. We better have a good reason not to. So I did not see any step away from the original interpretations of statutes when they're first done. They do not like this back and forth without any congressional input and making 180 returns, I think. So the other aspect of this that Cass Sunstein has pointed out, I don't want to grab his glory because I had not thought of this when I first read it, but he notes that Roberts goes out of his way to say that Congress can allow certain kinds of deference or respect on certain issues of expertise. It's not clear what he means by that, but I'm sure that those with Professor Levin's views are going to try and run a truck through it. And because it is interesting, because if they'll go back to the statute and find where maybe it's there, if not in the APA. We at NCLA had argued to beat the band that this was unconstitutional and urged them to reach the constitutional question. They did not reach the constitutional question. They did this statutorily, which I think, again, is a humility and not a power grab. They have not told Congress, you may not do this constitutionally, which I wish they had, but they've said, why don't you start looking at what you want these agencies to do And then you put in a statute what you want these agencies to do. And if you do that, we'll take another look. So I think is, as Professor Eskridge sometimes talks about in his legislative analysis, it's something of a chat between the branches on this issue. So we're very happy. You know, we go back down, we'll go back down to have this looked at without Chevron, and it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting what the courts do, because as I said, the D.C. District Court thought the law was clear, and Judge Smith thought, you know, without Chevron, I think he thought, I'm not, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but my impression is it, without Chevron, you don't get this. So we may be back up. I do think that the anti-government movement started in this aspect in 1789 and not a few years ago. So I do think it is returned to those type of principles, and I do welcome it. But I don't. But part of our differences may just be that I don't think that they're going to be. They're not going to be hostile to what I'll call real expertise. When the Nuclear Regulatory Committee Commission says this many Rotkins are bad for people, I don't see the courts not giving that high Skidmore respect. And similarly, if one is highly concerned about the fate of the Washington Western gray squirrel, I think that once again, whatever science went into figuring out whether that is a distinct species or not, as Justice Kagan was concerned about, that type of science, once again, there's going to have to be something on the other side. This idea that courts with all these liberal arts majors who took government and English and stuff are going to be saying, no, that's not how DNA works, is I'm highly skeptical of. I think it's going to be more in this vein where the administrative agency wants to do something that Congress itself had not done in the statute.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.